Chapter 40. The tents were not designed to serve as permanent and began to deteriorate after 6 months in the elements. The rainy season was over, but the water and mud had stained them so badly that the rows of crisp white tents were now a hodgepodge of brown dwellings, patched with strips of old clothes and scraps of plastic and sheet metal. Some sagged, others completely collapsed. Still others had been moved to other sections of the sprawling camp, many replaced by shanties erected with cardboard and whatever materials could be found. The baking sun further eroded the tent's stitching, seams, and zippers. Patching the holes became a daily chore. Beatrice purchased 3 bright blue tarps at the market, one for her, 2 for her friends on either side, and they draped them over their roofs and tried to secure them with baling wire. The tarps were a luxury and soon attracted unwanted attention. Each morning they arose early and left to find a line at a food distribution point. After breakfast, she and her friends walked their 8 children to school an hour away. Another friend, an elderly gentleman across the alley, kept an eye on their tents. Beatrice paid him with tins of canned meat. Tensions were mounting in the camp as ethnic rivalries spilled over the border and as the war back home raged on. The Dinka were blamed by the Nuer, Bari, and Azandi for causing the current war, the atrocities, the diaspora that forced them into the refugee camps. Insults were common, and then the fighting began. Teenagers and old men in gangs attacked each other with sticks and rocks. Ugandan soldiers were sent in to quell the violence, and their presence became part of life at Rhino. With hatreds that went back for decades, the atmosphere was tense, a powder keg waiting for a match. One morning, Beatrice and her friends returned from the walk to school and at first noticed nothing unusual. The coveted blue tarps were in place, but inside the tents, everything was gone. Thieves had slashed gaps in the rear of the tents and stolen their food, clothing, blankets, pillows, empty water jugs, the central t-shirts and souvenirs, everything. Their guard, the old man across the alley, and a Dinka, was missing. The 3 women did not panic and said nothing. To do so would be to attract even more unwanted attention. And where would they report the crimes? There were no police, and the Ugandan soldiers were there to stop the fighting, not waste time with petty crime. They went about the task of figuring out how to patch their tents again. When she was alone, Beatrice sat in hers and had a good cry. How could someone steal from the poorest souls on earth? Central finished the month of February with 3 more wins, at home against Norfolk State and Delaware State, and on the road at Eastern Shore. They were 12-5 in conference, 16-13 overall, and gearing up for the MEAC tournament, one they had to win to advance to the big dance. Sully was averaging 31 points and 8 rebounds a game. He had worked his way into the starting lineup and getting 32 minutes, more than anyone except Mitch Rocker, who rarely came out. The team had settled nicely into an 8-man rotation with Murray and Rocker in the front court, Sully and Roy Tice at forward, and Melvin Montgomery at center. Dimitri Robbins, Duffy Sunday, and Jabari Nix came off the bench and were getting plenty of time. The season's final game was at home against Florida A&M, the regular season champs at 15-2. The game was on a Saturday afternoon, March 5th, and 3 days before, during a practice, the AD interrupted things with the thrilling news that ESPN was coming to the Nest. The news electrified the campus as 8,000 students scrambled for tickets. The gym's capacity was only 3,500, and a fourth of the seats belonged to season ticket holders. Coach Britt set aside 5 passes for each player. Sully gave 3 to some girls he was hanging out with. He was featured in a pregame story that tracked the last 9 months of his life. There was footage of him hamming it up in Orlando with the boys from South Sudan, and a canned shot of the refugee camp at Rhino Camp South. The reporter talked about the violence back home, the death of his father, the plight of his mother and brothers. There was a request to interview him for the segment, but Coach Britt said no. He didn't want the distraction, and he didn't want any player to get too much attention. Sully was fine with the decision. Miss Ida had warned him to stay away from reporters, and Coach Britt concurred. On game day, the fans arrived early and choked the aisles. Maintenance had managed to squeeze in temporary bleachers for 300 more, a move that required approval from City Hall. The mayor of Durham was a Central alum, and the AD fixed her up with great seats. An hour before tip-off, the band roared to life, and the students danced under the backboard. The cheerleaders kept the frenzy going. The Eagle dance team shimmied and pulsated. The Nest had never been so packed or so loud. When FAMU jogged onto the court to warm up, they were met with a thunderous wave of boos. Seconds later, Mitch Rocker led Central under the court, and the place exploded. After the initial roar, the students immediately began their now customary chant of "Suli, Suli, Suli." He smiled, laughed with his teammates, did his layups and dunks, and tried to ignore the racket. He knew he was being watched closely, and he had become accustomed to the attention, but it was difficult to ignore and often an irritating distraction. Life off the court was getting complicated, and he didn't much like it. Murray was becoming his advisor, screener, protector, pit bull. Murray was also assuring him that there was no jealousy on the team. Hell, they were thrilled to be in the midst of a 10-game winning streak and to have a sudden star scoring 30 points a game. Fire away, Suli. The crowd quieted somewhat for the national anthem, then exploded again when the Eagles' starters were introduced. Television cameras seemed to be everywhere. ESPN banners hung high in the corners. Coach Britt's dream opening was a long three by Suli to light up the gym. The play had been practiced at length, because Suli could outjump Melvin Montgomery by at least 6 inches, as well as every other center in the conference. He was now handling the tip-off. For the fourth game in a row, he tapped it easily back to Murray, who brought the ball up the court. He pointed this way and that, called a play that didn't exist, seemed to be frustrated with something, shook his head, but kept an eye on the clock. At 20 seconds, every Eagle sprinted to a different spot. Suli spun from the free throw line, darted to the basket, lost his defender to a hard screen by Roy Tice, popped out under the basket with 1 foot out of bounds, kept moving, peeled off another screen, and caught a bounce pass in the corner 30 feet from the basket, with a defender scrambling to catch up. He pulled up high and lofted a perfect jump shot. When it hit the bottom of the net, the Nest exploded. It would take a few minutes for the FAMU players to adjust to the mayhem, to realize they couldn't hear each other or their coach, to find their groove, to just settle down and play basketball. In the meantime, it was bombs away. The second time down the court, Mitch Rocker whipped a pass behind his back and Suli caught it as he skied from 24 feet. On the other end, FAMU burned almost the entire shot clock before kicking the ball out of bounds. On Central's third possession, Murray missed a short jumper, but followed it in, got his rebound, bounced it out to Mitch Rocker, who faked a shot, got his man in the air, then fired a pass to Suli, who was well covered. Didn't matter. With his defender hanging on, he sprang high and hit his third straight. A whistle nailed the obvious foul, and Suli converted for a gorgeous four-pointer. He had the first 10 points of the game, and in less than 2 minutes. FAMU missed again, and Mitch Rocker walked the ball up. Suli popped out of the scrum and took a pass standing 35 feet from the basket. He faked a shot, sending two defenders high in the air. He then streaked for the basket and dished off to Roy Tice for an easy dunk. Down 12-0, FAMU took a timeout. The Rattlers were not 15-2 by accident, and within 5 minutes closed the gap to 16-10. After making his first dramatic threes from long range, Suli cooled off and missed his next two. On a short jumper, he drew a foul from his man, a good defensive player. Suli decided to work on the third foul, which was called at 8:04. During a TV timeout at 3:56, Central led 39-34, and an old-fashioned shootout was underway. At that pace, both teams would score at least 90. At the half, Central led 48-41. Suli had 19 points and was 5-for-9 from behind the arc. FAMU tied the game at 60. Seconds later, Suli's man got his fourth foul. His replacement was 2 inches shorter and a step slower. It was time to make a move. Murray fed him at the top of the key, and Suli drilled an 18-footer. The teams swapped baskets, and the lead changed as both defenses began to lag from fatigue. Sully realized his man was no match and began waving for the ball. He hit two straight threes and suddenly Central was up by 10. The lead vanished when Sully took a breather at 5-10. Mitch and Murray took turns missing bad shots and Lonnie screamed himself hoarse. They couldn't hear him anyway. He called time with 4 minutes to go, trailing by 2. Sully re-entered the game and his coach gave him the look. Start shooting and don't miss. He hit two straight and the students spilled out of the bleachers. He missed one, then hit another, all from far beyond the arc. The Rattlers picked an unfortunate time to go cold, and Central was poised to run them out of the gym. When Sully hit his 11th three-point shot out of 20, FAMU used its last timeout to stanch the bleeding, but it was too late. At the buzzer, the students stampeded onto the court in a rowdy celebration. The players were swarmed and hugged and high-fived and thoroughly adored. ESPN was thrilled not only with such an exciting game, but also with the discovery of a true star, one it had introduced to the rest of the country. Sully scored 47 points, had 11 rebounds, and 10 assists, a triple-double. An announcer on the sideline tried to interview him, but he was too busy working his way off the court. He and Murray fled to the Walkers for a Sunday night pizza. Life in the dorm had become too complicated. Interruptions at all hours, girls knocking on the door. Indeed, Sully was finding it difficult to do anything on campus other than hide in the gym. 6 weeks earlier, he'd hardly been noticed in class. Now he was signing autographs and posing for photos. A 10-minute walk from one class to another took forever, as he was pestered. Everyone wanted a photo, something to post, something to brag about. Even reporters were calling. He was ignoring social media altogether. In the basement game room, they watched North Carolina hand Duke its first and only loss of the season, a double overtime thriller at Cameron. They watched SportsCenter for the recap and waited for some highlights from the other campus in Durham. It finally came, and it was worth the wait. They had spliced together a video of all 11 three-point shots, and there was Sully gunning from all over the court as the host narrated the assault. A brief clip showed the cheerleaders in the crowd as Sully, Sully, Sully shook the building. "A star is born," declared the host. Samuel loved it. Murray was proud of his friend, but he was also beginning to worry. Chapter 41. Samuel moved into the Walker's basement, and Murray settled into his old bedroom upstairs. Early Monday morning, Ida called Coach Britt and unloaded about how the kid was being treated. He couldn't go to class, couldn't stay in his dorm room, couldn't enjoy a meal in the cafeteria, couldn't even walk across campus without drawing a crowd. Lonnie was concerned and promised that Sully's well-being was his greatest priority. Before practice, Lonnie met with the seniors, Mitch Rocker, Roy Tice, and Dimitri Robbins, and discussed the problem and ways to handle it. If they took a heavy-handed approach and demanded that the students and fans back off, then their young star might appear arrogant and ungrateful. If they did nothing, Sully might succumb to all those girls and other distractions. They decided to ignore it for now and get out of town. Early Tuesday morning, the bus left campus for the 3-hour ride to Norfolk and the MEAC tournament. The players would miss almost a full week of classes, and the coaches pushed them to study on the bus. They opened their laptops and textbooks, put on their headphones, and promptly fell asleep. When they were awake, they listened to music and played video games. The top 8 teams in the conference would square off in the Norfolk Scope, a 10,000-seat arena that had hosted the tournament many times. The winner received an automatic bid to March Madness. Everybody else went home. The games began at noon Wednesday, and from the first whistle, nothing went as predicted. FAMU, the number 1 seed, was apparently still hungover from its visit to Durham the previous Saturday and came out flat. NCA&T, the 8th seed, shot 70% for the game and won by 18. A week earlier, FAMU had been 24-5 and seemed a cinch for the NCAA tournament. Suddenly, they were scrambling to catch an earlier flight back to Tallahassee and wondering what happened to their season. In the second game, Norfolk State, the 7th seed, easily manhandled Howard, the number 2 seed, and sent the Bison home in a hurry as well. Before the third game, Coach Britt yelled at his players and told them that all the underdogs were winning. They might be 11-point favorites against South Carolina State, but season records and Vegas odds meant nothing. His message was well received. Sully scored 15 points in the first half, 19 in the second, but he was proudest of his 8 assists, 5 of which went to Murray, who scored 18 points, his career high. 6 Eagles hit for double figures, and the team shot 64%. It was their 12th straight win. Number 13 followed the next day with a rout of Delaware State. After the game, the team showered quickly and returned to the stands to watch Norfolk against A&T. They would play the winner on Saturday with the title on the line, with an automatic bid to the madness. Because their campus was close by, Norfolk State drew a large, boisterous crowd, and the scope was more than half full at tip-off. The Eagles found an empty section up near the ceiling and snacked on pizza and hot dogs hauled in by the managers. Murray ventured away to find a restroom, and as he was headed back to his seat, he was confronted by one of the friendliest faces he had ever seen. Huge smile, perfect teeth, hand thrust out with the greeting, "Hey, Murray, I'm Raynard Owen with Team Savage. Got a minute?" It was more of an assault, and Murray had no choice but to take his hand and shake it. "Team who?" "Team Savage. We're a sports management company based out of Miami." Murray managed to free his hand and take a step back, disengaged but still very much captive. "What kind of company, you say?" "Sports management. We represent professional athletes, mainly basketball players." "Oh, I see. You're an agent." Raynard shook it off with an even broader smile. "No, I'm not. But my boss is." Murray took another step back as reality finally hit. Okay, I got you now. You want to talk about my roommate, but you don't want to approach him because that would violate NCAA regs and you don't want to get on the blacklist. Who's your boss, you say?" "Arnie Savage. Reps a lot of big names."
"Such as?"
Like a magician, Raynard pulled a business card out of the air and said, "Too numerous to mention. Take a look at his website. Lots of stars. You think Sully might want to talk?"
"No, he does not want to talk. Not now, anyway. Such a conversation is off limits during the season. You know that. I'm not even sure this conversation is a good idea."
Murray started to shove the card back, but decided to keep it for future reference and stuck it in his pocket. Raynard, who lived this routine daily, had heard it all before and had a dozen routine responses.
"Nothing wrong with the two of us having a chat, Murray, now or later, but that kid better get ready for it. He's headed for the draft."
"Don't tell me anything about Sully,"
Murray said, suddenly irritated.
"I've been with him every day since August, and I bang heads with him in practice. I've watched him grow and know him better than anyone."
"He's probably a lottery pick."
"No, he's not. What do you know?"
"It's my business."
"Oh, really? Did you play in college?"
"Community school near Chicago."
Raynard shot back, unfazed.
"Okay, look, I'm not strutting here, but I do play at this level, and I know the game. I know Sully better than anyone, and he ain't ready for the NBA.
Actually, there had been whispers in the locker room. An obscure and less than reliable online scouting blog had listed Samuel Suleiman as a potential new one-and-done after last Sunday's performance against FAMU. But then, what wasn't on the internet? Murray wasn't sure his roommate had even seen it, but there was talk, and that kind of gossip rarely died down, especially when the kid was hitting from almost mid-court. Raynard was a slick professional, and he never stopped smiling.
Okay, let's not argue here. His stock is going up with every game, and scouts are taking notice. Arnie Savage is the best in the business. Keep us in mind."
Murray smiled and said,
"Sure."
Returning to his seat, Murray debated telling Coach Britt about the encounter and decided to let it go. If Raynard was right, and a voice told Murray that he was indeed, then the vultures would soon descend. A month earlier, on January 9th, Central had picked up its first conference win on the road in Greensboro against its biggest rival, North Carolina A&T.
It was a 15-point blowout over a seriously outmatched opponent. What no one at Central knew at the time was that six of A&T's players, including three starters, were in the clutches of a nasty bout of food poisoning and almost too weak to get dressed. The coach did not complain, but during a routine phone conversation the following day, he mentioned this to Lonnie, an old friend. Once over the bad food, A&T put together a respectable season, finishing 18-12 and 9-9 in conference. On Thursday night, they defeated Norfolk State in overtime to advance to the finals. On Saturday afternoon, they lined up against Central for the right to advance to the NCAA tournament. For the sixth straight game, Sully easily controlled the tip-off, slapping it back to Mitch Rocker. The design play worked perfectly until the shot bounced off the rim. Sully missed his first four long attempts and stopped shooting. His defender, Carson, was a 6'6 strong forward who pinched, grabbed, shoved, and never stopped talking trash. He and Sully tied up on a loose ball and hit the floor, squirming. Two refs dived between them to prevent a brawl, and both players got up ready to fight. The teams were separated, and both coaches settled down their players. Sully, though, had been talked out of his game. He sat the remaining 10 minutes of the first half, sulking, the smile gone. A&T led by 8. He had only 2 points, a cheap putback. Out of sync on both ends, Coach Britt had his work cut out for him at halftime. He barked at Sully, told him to stop pouting like a 10-year-old, get in the damned game physically and mentally, and so on. Sully would start the second half down low and try to draw fouls on Carson. Central's two guards, Murray and Mitch Rocker, slowed down the game and kept the score close. At 14-20, A&T was up by 10 when Carson got his third whistle. Sully watched with a smile as Carson went to the bench, then hit 2 free throws. It was time for the long game. Sully moved outside, worked through a screen, took the pass, pulled up from 25 feet, and hit his first bomb. His defender, a 6'5 redshirt freshman, appeared glued to the floor. Murray stole the inbound pass and fired a bullet across the court to his roommate, who was in the vicinity of his last launching point. Sully hit another. Carson's pit stop was brief. At 12:40, he hustled back into the game and immediately bumped into Sully, hard. A ref was watching and warned him. Sully just smiled and relaxed. Roy Tice hit a short bank shot to tie the score. On defense, Sully backed off Carson, daring him to take a shot. He was not a scorer, but wide open, he had no choice. Sully sprang high, slapped it away, and then laughed in his face. A long rebound kicked out to Mitch, who bounced it to Murray in the middle for a 3-on-1. Sully, blitzing from the left, took a short bounce pass and was soaring for a dunk when Carson assaulted him from behind with a fierce body block. Sully sprawled into the backboard padding and landed hard. Whistles shrilled from all directions as the refs ran in quick to avoid a war. Lonnie was yelling for a technical, and both benches were inching onto the floor. Sully bounced up with a smile and said he was okay. The assistant coaches got their players back where they belonged, and the situation settled down. A ref got in Carson's face and pointed toward the locker room. It was flagrant, no question about it, and he was out of the game. Sully made both free throws. On the inbound, Lonnie called for a play they had perfected. Sully bounced off 2 screens, took the ball deep in a corner, alone, and hit his 4th 3 of the game. Central was up by 5. The flagrant foul and the near fight ignited the Eagles, and they could feel a run. After winning 13 in a row, and all by double figures, they knew the game and the title belonged to them. They also knew their star had finally found his range. With 7 minutes to go, a tight game became a blowout as A&T's defense withered under a barrage of Sully's long jumpers mixed brilliantly with slashing drives to the basket. He ended up with 28 points, the tournament MVP award, and the Eagles left the court holding a MEAC championship trophy for the 2nd time in their history. The bus ride home was a riot. Chapter 42. Sunday, usually known as the Sabbath, but on March 13th, even better known as Selection Sunday, the doors to the nest opened at 2 p.m., and the students streamed in. For only the 2nd time in Central's history, the team had made it to March Madness, and it was a moment to be savored. A celebration was in order. A trophy was coming home, one that would be enshrined in the lobby and admired for decades to come. The crowd was there to celebrate, to say thanks, to admire their heroes, and to find out who their next opponent would be. There were no worries about making it to the big dance. Yesterday's win gave the Eagles an automatic bid. Others might be sweating the cut, but not Central. For smaller schools and less dominant programs, an invitation meant a ticket to join the biggest party in all of American sports. The Perennials took the trip for granted. Another 3 or 4 games added to the end of each season's schedule. For the others, though, it was a rare and cherished moment. Coach Britt held a team lunch in the locker room. As the players gathered, they watched the ESPN and CBS experts ramble on with their bracketologies and predictions. Trying to guess where the committee would place 68 teams was impossible, but had never stopped the analysts from trying. In the midst of the avalanche of data, it was mentioned several times that North Carolina Central, with an automatic bid, had the worst record in the field at 20-13. It was also noted that the team had won 14 straight, all going away, and had a star freshman who was averaging 30 a game. These little bits were offered quickly because no one took Central seriously. It was, after all, an HBCU, and those schools had always struggled in the tournament. The MEAC title did little to impress the commentators. The NCAA postseason playoffs began in 1939 as a single elimination tournament with 8 teams. It expanded to 16 teams in 1952 and 32 in 1978. As the college game gained popularity and became more exciting with dunks, three-pointers, and a shot clock, the tournament, nicknamed and then branded as March Madness, kept growing. In 2000, it doubled in size again, with 64 teams, half of which received automatic bids by winning their conference titles. The expansion was deemed wide enough, but every year there was controversy as a few teams were left out. In 2011, an attempt to remedy this was put in place with the addition of 4 play-in games for low-seeded teams. Dubbed the First Four, these early games were played in Dayton, Ohio. Coach Britt, like all coaches, desperately wanted to avoid the First Four. The extra game meant a long road trip and less time for practice, and the play-in teams were routinely routed in the first round. As he and his assistants ate sandwiches and chips with the players, they listened to the experts. Though no two agreed on much of anything, there seemed to be a general consensus that Central, its automatic bid notwithstanding, was headed for a play-in game. The Eagles' 13 losses bothered everyone but them. The team enjoyed the atmosphere and soaked in the glory of a fine winning season, especially after such an awful start. One more game, and a slice of March Madness, was icing on the cake. Lonnie now averaged 21 wins a year for the past 5 seasons, and though he was focused on his boys, his thoughts of moving on had been revived. He was still reeling from a back-channel call last night from an old acquaintance. An offer from an ACC school to be associate head coach would be arranged, but he had to bring Suli with him. Lonnie had been so shocked by the call that he had yet to whisper it to his wife. The sport could be treacherous. The racket from outside was growing as the bleachers and stands shook the floor. The band was at full volume. At 3 p.m., it was time for the team to make their appearance. Mitch Rocker held the MEAC tournament trophy and led the team down the tunnel to the floor and onto a stage under a retracted backboard. The gym exploded with a roar that surprised the players. The court was packed with students pushing toward the stage like crazed fans at a rock concert. It took a long time to calm them, but when things calmed down, the speeches began. The president, a dean, the director of athletics. The scoreboard hung from the ceiling and was positioned high above mid-court. A jumbotron was on the wish list, but years away. 4 large screens had been mounted, one in each corner of the court, and before Coach Britt took the mic, there was a 10-minute highlight reel of the season, with heavy emphasis on the past 10 games. The students screamed every time Suli hit another bomb. Coach Britt thanked them for their support. He and Mitch handed over the trophy to the AD. Lonnie asked Suli to step forward and presented him with the plaque as tournament MVP. For at least the fourth time in the past hour, the chant of Suli, Suli, Suli rattled the windows. When it subsided, Coach Britt motioned toward the mic, but Suli quickly begged off. The idea of making a speech terrified him. There was a break in the action as they waited for the selection. At 4, the crowd grew quiet and the players took their seats on the stage. CBS and its A-team began by announcing the first 4 national seeds, Duke, Gonzaga, Villanova, and Kansas. Then the first 4. Cornell would play in against UMass, DePaul would play in against Iowa State, BYU would play in against Creighton. And Florida would play in against the Eagles of North Carolina Central, a 16th seed. The crowd roared with delight. The players jumped up with high fives and celebrated for the cameras. The coaches bear-hugged each other as if a quick trip to Dayton, followed by a game with Duke, was just exactly what they had in mind. With a big smile, Lonnie looked at Jason Grinnell and said,
"What the hell?"
Jason, smiling, said,
"No respect, man. No respect."
Coach Ron McCoy quipped with a smile,
"We're so screwed."
The celebration eventually died down as the team and its fans watched the rest of the selection. The coaches managed to keep smiling and feigning excitement, but they felt as though they had been shafted. There was little time for a practice. They knew nothing about Florida, except that they had beaten Kansas in the SEC Big 12 Challenge and had beaten Kentucky in Rupp Arena in early January. In an up-and-down season, they had won 22, lost 12, split their conference games, then almost beaten Auburn in the tournament final. Lonnie left the stage and huddled with the AD. Travel plans had to be expedited. A private air charter would be needed, though it was certainly not in their budget. Other details were vague. They agreed that they got a raw deal, but they had made it to the big dance. Barely. And it was important to seize the moment. The assistant coaches were on their phones calling other coaches, scouts, former players, friends, anyone who might know anything about the Florida Gators. When the selection was over and the crowd filed out, the players returned to the locker room and dressed for practice. At 9 p.m., the first odds were posted online. Florida was a 26-point favorite. During the night, an ice storm swept through and paralyzed most of the state. At daybreak, the campus, as well as most of Durham and Raleigh, was without electricity. The airport was closed. The team's charter jet was stranded in Philadelphia. One option was to hop on a rented bus and head to Ohio, but the roads were treacherous for at least the first 100 miles, and no one was really that excited about spending the day on a bus. The gym was cold and dark. Practice was out of the question. Coach Britt paced around his house, draped in a blanket, waiting on cell service, waiting on electricity and heat, waiting for the damned ice to melt so he could get his team out of town. He almost cried when he glanced outside and saw snow falling on his patio. Around 1 p.m., the Raleigh-Durham airport opened with limited service. There was still no electricity in the area and computers weren't online. Some cell service returned around 3. Just after 4, the entire metro area blacked out again, as power was lost. At 8 a.m., Tuesday, game day, a charter bus left the nest with 10 players, 4 coaches, 4 team managers, the AD, 2 women on his staff, the sports information director, the director of basketball operations, a trainer, the team doctor, a strength coach, and a volunteer chaplain. For 2 hours, the driver inched along with the traffic on Interstate 40 until Raleigh was behind them. In Winston-Salem, he turned north on I-77 and confronted more ice and slow traffic. Coach Britt, as well as the other 3 coaches and half the players, tracked their progress with a cell phone app using GPS. Barring any more bad luck, they should reach Dayton at 6 p.m. Tip-off was at 8. Lonnie was certain that, in the colorful history of March Madness, no team had ever been so ill-prepared. He stayed on his phone, calling friends in the business who might be able to pass along even the slightest insight into the Florida players and coaches. His assistants did the same.
The AD, after reporting the team's travel progress to a contact person with the NCAA and lodging another complaint about getting such a raw deal, called the AD at Florida and discussed the possibility of delaying the game for an hour. The players needed to stretch, unwind, shoot a few, grab something to eat. The Florida AD agreed, but the NCAA said no. There was a contract with CBS. The Gators had zipped into Dayton by charter jet Monday afternoon and enjoyed a nice practice. They had returned to the court midday Tuesday for a leisurely shoot-around. The Eagles arrived at the University of Dayton Arena at 6:10. A local television station had been alerted to the story, and the players were filmed getting off the bus, finally. Coach Britt had no comment. They changed quickly into their maroon road uniforms and took the court. Florida had agreed to keep the gym locked until 7 to allow a short, private practice. In spite of the ice and delays and interminable bus ride, the players were in great spirits and even laughed at their misfortune. Caged for 10 long hours, they were eager to stretch, sprint, jump, and burn off some energy. Lonnie would later say that it was the best half hour of practice of the season. Back in the locker room, they feasted on power bars and sports drinks and quietly listened to music with headphones. There were some nervous whispers, a laugh or two. When it was time for the show, Lonnie huddled them close and said,
"Two things, man. There are two things I want you to know. First, the experts believe we are 26-point underdogs. 26. That means that they believe we don't belong here. We're not good enough. We've lost too many games. It means that no one respects us. Not those people out there. Not the other team. Not the selection committee. Nobody at the NCAA. Nobody in the press. None of the talking heads on television. We have not one ounce of respect anywhere. So, men, we have to earn it. The second thing is this."
Lonnie held up a sheet of paper.
"This is from the Tampa Bay Times, the largest newspaper in Florida. Its sports writers cover the University of Florida. Yesterday, a reporter had a chat with Jerry Biles, Florida's head coach. I know Jerry. He's okay."
With drama, Lonnie studied the sheet of paper.
"They were discussing the big game this Friday up in Memphis when Florida will play Duke, the number one national seed, in the first round. Here is what Coach Biles had to say, and I quote, 'We got an easy draw in the first round, not so easy in the second, but we're not afraid of Duke. We beat Kansas and Kentucky, and we can play with anyone. Bring them on.'"
He lowered it, glared at his players, and repeated,
"An easy draw."
He wadded it up and tossed it away.
"An easy draw, and they're already talking about Duke Thursday night in Memphis. As if this game is already over. As if we don't exist."
No one moved. No one seemed to breathe. Not a sound. He lowered his voice and said,
"I doubt if these jackasses have even bothered to scout us, so we'll shake things up a bit. Sully, you're not starting. You're going around 3 minutes, so stay ready. We'll run Kobe 4, so lock in now on the shot."
He tapped his palms together and said,
"Men, we don't deserve respect. Yet. Respect is out there on the floor, just waiting for us to go get it."
Chapter 43. Florida controlled the tip, and Central went into a half-court press, with every player itching to scratch and claw and ready to fight off screens. A bad jumper bounced off the rim, and Melvin cleared it to Rocker, who took his time bringing the ball up court. With 8 seconds on the shot clock, Murray missed a 20-footer. Florida missed again, as did Central. Both teams were sky-high and still nervous. The ice was broken when Murray mishandled a pass that led to an easy, fast break. Florida had 2 5'10" senior guards who were quicker and faster than anything Central had seen in the MEAC. The first foul was whistled at 16:38, and Coach Britt yelled for Sully. Down the court, he posted high and at 15 seconds sprinted toward the goal, fought off a screen, and popped out clear in the far corner. The pass from Mitch was perfect, as was the 30-footer. 2 days of complete rest proved beneficial, and the Eagles were more intense than Lonnie had ever seen them. The ice storm had delivered a gift. They smothered Florida's bigs, and the two small guards weren't hitting. When Sully hit his third straight three from downtown, a whistle blew for the under-16-minute timeout. Central was up, 11-6, and Florida seemed off balance. In the huddle, Coach Britt continued to hammer away at their role as heavy underdogs who got no respect from Florida or anyone else. He challenged them to play harder. Florida made no adjustments and seemed willing to see if Sully might cool off. He did not. He missed his fourth attempt, hit his fifth from 28 feet, and the next time down pumped a fake, sent his man flying, drove hard to the rim, and dished off to Roy Tice for an easy dunk. The score was 16-8, and Florida took a timeout. In the 14 games he had played, Sully was hitting 47% of his threes, second in the nation. He had no preferred spot. He hit from deep in the corners, fading away, and from near mid-court. Many games ago, his coaches had realized that, for an offense otherwise lacking in gunners, Central's best game plan was to let the kid fire away at will. Aside from his accuracy, what made his game so lethal was that he often followed his shot and picked off long rebounds that he converted to easy assists down low. Florida went to their box and won and put a 6'5 pickpocket on Sully. Every time he touched the ball, Sully either took a shot or faked one. The fakes were deadly, as the defender either took the bait or fouled him as he tried to drive. At halftime, he had 24 points on 6 bombs and 6 free throws. Central led, 41-30, but the game did not seem as close as the score. In the locker room, Coach Britt continued his relentless attack on the experts who thought so little of his players. He challenged them to scrap with even more intensity in the second half. Florida stayed with the box and won, but put a different defender on Sully. He was just as ineffective as the previous two. When Sully hit 2 short jumpers and stunned the crowd with a behind-the-back alley-oop to Melvin, Florida called another timeout. Their coach stared at the scoreboard in disbelief, 50-34. The Gators were fading and sniping at each other. The sky was falling, and there was no way to stop it. When the lead was 20, with 9 minutes to go, Sully finally saw the chance to make a flashy move, one he had never pulled off in a game. He tried it in a practice several times, with mixed success. The game was not out of reach, and Florida had plenty of time for a run, and the last thing he wanted to do was to inspire his opponents with some playground antics. He had an entire repertoire, tricks and odd shots that he learned in the dirt courts of Lota. But what the hell? The South Sudanese were known for their daring and risk-taking, and if it worked, it would top the SportsCenter highlight reel for the first 4 games. He took a pass at the free throw line with his back to the goal. With both hands, he fired the ball over his head, a bullet that had no chance of going through the rim. It wasn't supposed to. He quickly spun around, hooked his man, and caught the ball in the lane as it rebounded hard off the backboard. Melvin recognized the play and got in position. Sully, still airborne and seemingly weightless, held the ball for a split second, then floated a soft pass toward the rim as Melvin sprung behind the confused Florida bigs and slammed it down. The official scorer, also confused, had no choice but to call it a missed shot, followed by an assist. Sully didn't care. Lonnie didn't either. It was 2 more points and a backbreaker. Florida called another timeout as the Eagles mobbed Sully and the crowd went wild. With 6 minutes to go, Sully shot from the arc, followed it, missed, and watched a long rebound turn into an easy Gator basket. They pressed full court and forced Murray to kick one out of bounds. A 10-0 run followed, and the Florida bench came to life. At 3:35 and up 66-56, Lonnie called time and settled down his players. He asked Sully if he needed a break, and he said nope. He would not take a break in the second half. The Eagles had not won 14 in a row with a controlled offense, and Lonnie was not about to try something new. With every defender keeping an eye on Sully, Mitch Rocker hit a wide-open 3, and 30 seconds later, Murray did the same. Florida pushed the ball hard, pressed hard, and was soon running out of gas. Sully had plenty left.
He hit his 9th three with 140 left to put the game out of reach, 80-63. Florida took a bad shot, and the rebound kicked out to Murray, who gave no thought to burning the clock. He bounced a pass across the court to Suli, who was wide open at 30 feet and could have either killed time or driven to the basket. He chose neither and pulled up for his 10th three. His performance fueled the CBS game recap as the country got its first look at the freshman sensation. The blind pass off the backboard dominated the highlights as the commentators shook their heads. He scored 46, seventh on the all-time tournament list, but still far behind the seemingly untouchable record put up by Notre Dame's Austin Carr. In a 1970 game against Ohio, Carr scored 61 points, and that was before the three-point shot. With it, Carr would have scored 75. Suli was 10 for 22 from the arc, 8 for 9 from the stripe, with 11 rebounds, 6 assists, 4 steals, and 4 blocks in 35 minutes. The win was Central's first ever in the tournament, and it did much to melt the remaining ice in Durham. Parties broke out all over campus and in the student apartment complexes nearby. The bars were packed and rowdy, and up and down the streets, the chant of Suli, Suli, Suli echoed through the night. Chapter 44. The coaches met promptly at 7:30 for breakfast in the hotel restaurant. They huddled in a booth in a remote corner and sipped coffee as they waited for menus. None of the four could stop smiling. Lonnie put his cell phone in the middle of the table and said, "All phones here, and turned off. Mine hasn't stopped buzzing." The other three phones hit the table. Jason Grinnell said, "Suli called me at 6 this morning, and it was during one of those brief periods when I was actually asleep." "What did he want?" asked Lonnie. "Well, today is Wednesday, and he talks to his mother every Wednesday morning at 7.
"He didn't wake you up to tell you that,"
said Ron McCoy.
"Hang on. He said he had a dream, a bad one that involved a problem with an airplane. Said it's a bad omen, and he thinks we should take the bus to Memphis. They say the kid is really superstitious."
Lonnie said,
"That'll save $60,000 for the air charter. Our AD will love that."
McCoy said,
"The equipment managers can't find his socks after the games. He takes them with him."
Grinnell said,
"Yeah, Murray says he washes them himself and hangs them in a window. Said he's been doing it since the first game he played."
"Well, at least they're getting washed."
A waitress stopped by and handed over menus. When she left, Lonnie said,
"I like it. Let's take the bus and forget going home. I want to keep Suli away from the campus, away from everybody. I got 50 emails last night from reporters, other coaches, old friends I haven't talked to in months. Everybody wants a piece of the kid right now."
Jackie Garver said,
"According to Murray, the girls are driving him crazy."
"Those were the days,"
McCoy said with a laugh. Lonnie said,
"Tell the managers to let them sleep. We'll leave around 11 and take our time getting to Memphis."
"By bus?"
"Yes. If Suli wants to ride the bus, then so be it."
Duke versus Central. The number one seed versus a number 16, a play-in. Never in the tournament's storied history had a number 16 beaten a number 1. Same for 15, 14, 13. Duke versus Central, the other school in Durham. Duke, with its 5 national championships, its roll call of 32 All-Americans, its 41 tournament appearances, 16 conference championships, its current streak of 22 consecutive weeks at number 1, and on and on. Across town, Central's numbers were far less impressive. Duke, with its tuition now at $50,000 a year, its endowment of $8 billion, its dozens of endowed professorships, its 95% graduation rate, its lofty rankings in medicine, law, engineering, the arts and sciences, its billions in research grants, and on. Rich versus poor, private versus public, elites versus upstarts.
The commentators feasted on the story, and everybody was looking for Sully. FedEx Forum, home of the Memphis Grizzlies and site of the South Regional. Arkansas is just next door, and its fans poured into the city to watch their beloved Razorbacks easily handle Indiana State in the first game. Feeling even more boisterous for the second round, the fans hung around and eagerly awaited the chance to show their anti-ACC sentiment against Duke. All 18,000 seats were packed with only a sprinkling of Blue Devil faithful. A thunderous round of booing greeted the number one seed as they took the floor. Seconds later, the crowd flipped immediately and began, "Sully, Sully, Sully," when Central appeared on the court. For Samuel, the moment was disconcerting. Who wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of such adulation? But he felt as though all eyes were on him. For the past 2 days, he had ignored the cameras and spoken to no one but his coaches and teammates. All of them were watching SportsCenter and following the storm on social media. They were determined to shield him from as many distractions as possible. He smiled and stretched and tried to ignore the crowd. He glanced at the Duke players on the other end and wondered if they were as nervous as he was. They appeared to be immune from the jitters, all calm, relaxed, confident. They were accustomed to being booed and jeered and thrived on creating such noisy resentment on the road. They were far from the madness of Cameron, but they played all their away games in hostile, crowded arenas. It was part of the Duke mystique, the Blue Devils against the world. Sully's man was Darnell Coe, a 6'8 small forward scoring 12 a game and considered the best Duke defensive player since Shane Battier. Sully glanced at Coe a couple of times and tried to ignore him. Coe, like all the Duke players, seemed to have no interest in the opposing team. As the lower seed, Central was introduced first and got a rousing welcome with the "Sully" chants drowning out the announcer. Duke's starters were heavily booed, but took it in stride. At midcourt, they made no effort to acknowledge the Eagles. Their center, Akeem Akaman, was 6'10". When he stepped forward for the tip-off, he scowled at Sully, who immediately sprang high and quick and swatted the ball back to Mitch Rocker. Central's first play was simple. They were where they were for one reason, Sully and his long game. That's where they would start. That's where they would live or die. He posted high, then sprinted deep into the front court, took a bounce pass from Mitch, and dribbled the ball. He was 35 feet from the basket, and Coe gave him some room, as if to say, "Go ahead." Sully sprung up and took the shot. He didn't follow, but instead backed away and was past midcourt when it landed in the bottom of the net. He skipped back and waved his arms as the crowd erupted. Duke had no weaknesses. Akaman and Kevin Washington could dominate inside, and Coe, Tyrell Miller, and Toby Frost could burn the nets from anywhere on the court. Central didn't have the bench to survive a physical game with lots of fouls, but no team could afford to give Duke room to run its offense. Coach Britta decided to play hard and aggressive and hope the refs didn't call a close game. Frost missed the first shot, and Roy Tice cleared the board. Mitch jogged up court with the ball, traded passes with Murray, and at 15 seconds, Sully swept back into the front court, took the ball, and launched another shot, this one a bit closer, from 32 feet. Nothing but net. The fans were beyond delirious. The plan was to start with Sully bombing away until he missed one. After a bucket by Akaman, Mitch pushed the ball up court in a hurry, and with only 10 seconds gone, found Sully deep in a corner with Coe sticking close. He faked a pass, then sprang from 30 feet. When his third shot found the net, the forum seemed to shake. Unrattled, Duke calmly went about its business on offense. Tyrell Miller bounced off a perfect screen and fired a 20-footer that didn't go. Akaman got the rebound, though, and slammed it home. Coe closed in tight and began grabbing and hacking. Sully peeled off screen after screen but couldn't shake him. When he got the ball for the fourth time, he faked a shot and sent Coe flying. He streaked for the basket, almost drew a charge, then whipped a perfect behind-the-back pass to Murray in the corner. He missed, and Kevin Washington got the rebound. Toby Frost dribbled the ball up and motioned for his teammates to settle down. At 17:40, Central led 9-4, and the jitters were gone. Frost nailed a 3, and Sully finally missed one. The teams swapped baskets, then swapped turnovers, and at the under 16-minute timeout, they were tied at 13. The game was off to a frantic start, with both teams seemingly poised to score 100. Duke's defense, though, found its rhythm and pressured the perimeter. Mitch and Murray tried to work the ball inside, but Roy Tice and Melvin Montgomery could not score. Coe stuck to Sully like glue and denied him the ball. When he finally took a pass, he launched another 30-footer, a bad shot that rebounded long and led to a beautiful 3-on-1 fast break. Coe was fierce and physical and didn't mind grabbing and hacking. When he hand-checked Sully hard, a clear foul, and drew no whistle, Lonnie erupted on the sideline and got a hard stare from a ref. He wouldn't shut up or back down. If the refs were allowing his star to get mugged, he was not about to stay quiet. He wanted a technical, and finally got one, his third of the season. As Tyrell Miller took the uncontested free throw, the crowd seemed ready to storm the court. Duke quickly pulled away, scoring inside and out, and with Sully bottled up, Central had no answer. Lonnie continued to work the refs, and they finally tightened up the game. Coe was whistled for 2 straight fouls and took a seat. Sully promptly nailed a 25-footer to cut the lead to 28-20 at 8:03. It was obvious that the rest of the team would struggle to score. During a Central timeout, Lonnie asked Sully if he needed a break. "No, sir, he wasn't coming out."
"The game is yours," Lonnie said. "Take it to the basket."
With Coe on the bench and with Duke protecting the perimeter, he began slashing to the lane. He finished some, dished others, and when Coe re-entered at 5:22, the score was 34-30. The obvious disadvantage of playing a well-coached team with 4 All-Americans was that someone always had a hot hand. Toby Frost hit 2 short jumpers, and Mitch was called for traveling. Frost then hit a 3, and Duke was up by 11. Central clawed back, had 3 impressive stops, then Sully hit his 5th 3-pointer. At the half, Duke led 46-35 and looked unbeatable. Sully had 22 points and was 5-for-10 from behind the arc. The locker room was quiet as the Eagles caught their breath and tried to absorb the enormity of facing more of the same in the second half. Lonnie and the coaches huddled and decided to try and slow down the game. Their man-to-man defense had just given up 46 points and looked helpless. They decided to start with a 2-3 zone, clog up the middle, and hope Duke cooled off from the outside. If that didn't work, and they had serious doubts, it would at least buy some time and save some legs for the finish. The zone worked well for a few minutes as both teams missed shots and threw the ball away. When Sully could get his hands on the ball, he fired away, but Coe was suffocating him and every shot was fiercely contested. At 17:25, Coe was called for his 3rd foul, but didn't leave the game. Sully was determined to draw the 4th and began driving. He lowered his shoulder and was whistled for his 2nd foul. At the first TV timeout, Duke led by 12, 52-40, and Sully had missed all 5 shots, long and short. He broke the drought with a 20-footer. Duke quickly answered. As Mitch walked the ball up the court, Coe grabbed Sully's jersey again, and their feet got tangled. Both went down hard, right in front of a ref who angrily pointed at Coe on the floor and whistled him for number 4. The Duke bench, always volatile, went nuts, and a few tense seconds followed. Coe left the game shaking his head. The announcers ran the replay, and there was no doubt he had grabbed Sully, spun him around, and tripped him up. Sully took the inbound pass, and in a split second, fired from the arc. Nothing but net. Tyrell Miller answered with a 3, far away from the zone. Back and forth, the teams traded misses and baskets. Duke went up by 14, and Central cut it to 8, but could get no closer. Lonnie called time at 7:08 for a breather, and Sully took a seat on the bench for a much-deserved break. Duke was up 64-54. When Sully re-entered at 5:50, Coe did the same, but with 4 fouls, he had to take a step back. Sully figured as much and launched 2 bombs. Both missed. With time running down, Lonnie ditched the zone and went to a half-court press, and Duke, uncharacteristically, had consecutive turnovers.
The Eagles were out of gas, but desperate to make a run. This was not the moment to think about fatigue. They fought to within 8, 72-64, and the crowd got back in the game. Duke settled down, worked the clock, and Kevin Washington hit a 3. With 3 minutes left, Duke forced a turnover that led to an easy basket, then blocked a shot that led to another. In a matter of seconds, it seemed, Duke was up by 15, and Coach Britt called time. The disappointed fans sat down and stared at the scoreboard. The forum had not been that quiet for hours. 158 remained. Duke, 79. Central, 64. The next 58 seconds would later be called the most exciting minute in tournament history. Murray inbounded the ball to Mitch, who rifled a pass to midcourt where Sully scooped it up, dribbled twice, and launched a 30-footer that found the net. 150. Tyrell Miller grabbed the ball, stepped out of bounds, and quickly bounced it inbounds to Toby Frost. However, Miller stepped on the baseline with his pass, and a ref saw it and whistled the infraction. Dimitri Robbins inbounded long to Sully, who was camping near midcourt. He pump-faked Coe, dribbled behind his back, and shot from 27 feet. Net. 144, 79-70. Central pressed full court, and Duke worked the ball up. Toby Frost broke free off a screen and was open until he wasn't. Sully came flying out of nowhere, blocked the shot, then sprinted 2-on-1 with Murray dribbling. He bounced it to his roommate, who pulled up from 29 feet and nailed his third in a row. 130, 79-73. Lonnie backed them away, and they pressed from half court. Murray deflected a bounce pass. The ball squirted loose, and four players piled on top of it. In the scrum, at least three of them fought over the ball, and the ref whistled a jump ball. Possession central. Sully fought his way through the lane and managed to crash Coe into a hard screen set by Melvin Montgomery. No foul was called as Coe almost fell to the floor. His man was alone in the corner, and Mitch fired a perfect pass. Sully hit his fourth in a row from 26 feet. 110, 79-76. Central went full court, and Murray and Mitch trapped Frost in a corner. His wild pass was picked off in midcourt by Dimitri, who, without a thought, led Sully with a perfect bounce pass. He launched from 28 feet, and when the ball swished the net, absolute bedlam rocked the forum. 79-79, with 1 minute to go. Duke, reeling, called timeout, and Central's bench smothered their star. Lonnie managed to seat his 5 and tried to settle them down, but the noise was deafening, and he had been hoarse for the entire second half. He switched to a tight man-to-man and told them to expect a long shot. He put Sully on Toby Frost and told him to foul if necessary. Frost calmly jogged the ball up the court, and Duke set its offense. 10 seconds. 15. Tyrell Miller set a hard ball screen for Frost, then rolled and took a perfect pass. At 41 seconds, Tyrell hit a 24-footer. Duke fell back and picked up Mitch, who passed to Murray. As Sully fought off Coe and tried to get open, a ref blew a whistle. Coe was called for his 5th foul, and Sully went to the line to shoot 2 with 18 seconds left. He hit the first, 82-80. Central needed 2 points, not 1, and nobody in the building expected Sully to put it in the net. As soon as the ref bounced him the ball, he fired at the rim and soared after the ball. When it bounced off the front of the rim, he slapped it to Murray, all alone in the corner. His 28-foot dagger was the shot of a lifetime, and Central was up by 1. Duke had plenty of clock and used its last timeout. Unable to sit and barely able to hear anything, the Central players huddled around Coach Britt and yelled at each other to dig in. Frost hurried the ball up court, swapped quick passes with Tyrell Miller, and neither could find an open man. With 5 seconds to go, Kevin Washington tried a turnaround jumper from the free throw line, but Roy Tice got a hand on it. The ball bounced to Murray, who saw his roommate streaking down the court. He lofted a long pass that Sully took on one bounce at their own free throw line and hurled himself into the air. Defying gravity, Sully soared through the forum, the ball in his right hand, high above his head, just like Niolo. He finished with a jarring, rim-rattling, windmill dunk that sent quakes all the way to South Sudan. A mob swarmed the court as the Eagles piled on top of each other at midcourt. Chapter 45. The locker room was remarkably subdued. The players were elated, but too stunned and exhausted to celebrate. And they were overwhelmed with emotion. Coach Britt kept the cameras and press out, the door locked and guarded by managers. He quietly went from player to player, hugging each, offering soft words of praise, and he wiped a few tears himself. After 15 minutes, he addressed his players and told them how much he loved them. His raspy, scratchy voice barely worked, and he couldn't think of much to say anyway. A manager stepped in to say that the tournament officials were waiting. Lonnie asked the three seniors, Mitch Rocker, Roy Tice, and Dimitri Robbins, to follow him. And Sully, too. The press room was packed. Lonnie took a seat in the middle of the table with two players on each side, and as soon as he adjusted his mic, the questions came in an avalanche. He smiled, held up both hands, and said,
"Please, just one at a time."
He pointed at a reporter in the front row.
"Coach, did you really believe you could win the game?"
Lonnie laughed, and his players smiled.
"I don't think I'll answer that question. Let's be honest, no one in this room thought we would win. I think we're all still in shock."
"Coach, was it your game plan to start with Sully bombing from midcourt?"
Another laugh.
"Yes, it was. Our game plan was simple. Just get the ball to Sully."
Every reporter held a game summary and knew the numbers. Sully scored 58, tying him with Bill Bradley for second most in a tournament game. He hit 14 threes, had 12 rebounds, 10 assists, 4 steals, 4 blocks. A triple-double.
"Coach, was the crowd a factor?"
"Well, I've never been in a place where I couldn't hear myself think. My ears are still ringing. As you can tell, I can barely talk, and at times I had trouble getting through to my players. But yes, having the crowd on our side was a factor."
"Coach, a question for Sully?"
Lonnie shrugged as if to say, "Fire away." With a big smile, Sully pulled his mic closer.
"Sully, you hit 14 threes, a tournament record. What were you thinking out there?"
Sully had yet to say a word to any reporter, and the world was waiting. He smiled and shrugged and looked uncomfortable. Finally,
"I don't know. I really wasn't thinking."
Everyone laughed.
"You know, the adrenaline was pumping so hard that you just play. You don't have time to think too much."
"Mitch, what's it like to watch a teammate do what Sully just did?"
Mitch leaned forward with a grin and said,
"No big deal, really. He does it every day in practice. When he gets hot, we just feed him the ball."
"Sully, you just scored 58 against a great defensive player. What do you think about Darnell Coe?"
"He's tough, one of the best, very physical, you know. All the Duke players are physical. That's their game. They're a great team."
Mitch leaned in again and added,
"The truth is, when he gets the ball, nobody can guard him. His shot is too quick and he springs too high. Sometimes in practice, we'll put 3 men on him just for fun. Once he gets up, though, you can't touch his shot."
"Coach, how do you get your team ready for the next game after a win like this?"
Lonnie replied,
"We'll be ready. I can promise you that."
Every reporter and every fan knew the story. The death of his father, the missing sister, his mother and brothers living in a refugee settlement. And every reporter wanted to ask something about the past year, but it wasn't the moment for that. Why do anything to dampen the kids' spirits? When they were finally dressed, the managers led the team through a side door. They walked 8 blocks through downtown Memphis to the Rendezvous, a famous ribs place in an alley. In a private room, they began to relax and were soon laughing. Tomorrow, they could sleep until noon. The upset owned the news. The other 7 games on Thursday ended as predicted, and there was no room for any other coverage. It was a nonstop barrage of Sully's greatest hits, his 14 threes, 5 in the span of 58 seconds to tie the game, his blocked shots. He had his own highlight reel. On Friday, he and Murray met Miss Ida and Ernie for a late lunch in the hotel restaurant. And Jordan, who had driven from Nashville for the game, she had planned to stay only for the Duke game, but was as happy as the rest to hang around for the next one. Murray had scored 12, including the golden three that put Central ahead 83-82 with 16 seconds to go. They replayed the game and delighted in the moment. Jordan sat close to Sully, knees touching knees, under the table, of course, because Miss Ida missed nothing. Later in the afternoon, the team had a light closed practice in an empty forum. Jason Grinnell went through a scouting report and tried to convince the team that Arkansas was unbeatable.
They knew better, and they were still thinking about Duke.
Lonnie suspected this and had another sleepless night. At 2 p.m. Saturday, the gates opened for the 3 o'clock game, and the Arkansas throng was back. They filled the forum early and made almost as much noise as they did on Thursday. Their love for Sully had soured quickly, and they were hungry for a win. The school had won national title back in 1994, and with Duke out of the way, the Razorbacks had a clear path to the next round. Sully picked up where he'd left off, and when he drained his second three, the crowd settled down. The Arkansas defense was jittery and panicked every time he touched the ball. It collapsed on him quickly and left plenty of gaps elsewhere. He began driving and dishing off for easy buckets. At halftime, he had 9 assists and 16 points. The second half turned into a horse race as both teams tried to outrun each other, but no one could outrun Sully. He scored 46 with 13 assists, and Central advanced with a 10-point win. Off to the Sweet 16. Chapter 46. By Monday morning, Lonnie Britt was sick of the word Cinderella. Every sportscaster and sports writer used it at least once per sentence. There were no other contenders. Out west, Utah State, a 10th seed, had knocked off UCLA, a number 4, in a mild upset, but nothing even remotely close to what happened in Memphis. Central's president was waiting, his door wide open, his secretary smiling as she offered pastries and coffee. Lonnie had never been so warmly received. As they settled into wide leather chairs, the AD arrived and the door was closed. Congratulations all around. What a weekend. They covered the logistics of going to Atlanta for the next round. How many tickets would be allotted? How many big donors would be included? Politicians were calling and wanting in. Alumni relations had never attracted so much attention. And the press. Hundreds of reporters and journalists were angling for stories and access, and while it was important to take advantage of a unique opportunity to market the school, Lonnie was much more concerned with protecting his players, especially Sully.
"Where is he?" asked the president.
"He's living in Murray Walker's basement. I think Ida's guarding the door. He's been there for a couple of weeks. The dorm got crazy."
"Is he going to class?"
"Yes, for the most part, but I doubt if many of the players are in class this morning. I'd like to leave for Atlanta tomorrow, after practice, just to get them out of town."
The AD frowned and said,
"And miss a whole week of classes?"
Lonnie laughed and said,
"Oh, so you think they'll study this week? We play Providence at 6 on Thursday afternoon, and that's all they're thinking about. This is too big. The kids are overwhelmed. I'd like to practice tomorrow at noon, then hit the road."
The AD looked at the president. Both knew the truth. With 3 wins already in the tournament, the money was pouring in. Start with the NCAA CBS contract, now worth over $500 million annually, and watch the money trickle down to the conferences and game winners. Central had already earned $600,000 that wasn't expected. And in March Madness, the more you win, the more you earn. Whatever Coach Britt wanted. Because he felt he had to, the president said,
"Okay, fine with me, but please instruct your players to get their assignments and study in their free time."
"Of course,"
Lonnie replied, because he had to. He would not monitor a single laptop. It was only March. The players had plenty of time to catch up in class, and he had no plans to nag his guys during the greatest week of their lives. The AD said,
"We have rooms at a new Marriott downtown, 2 players per room. Lonnie smiled and said,
No thanks. We've already scoped out the hotels, and I don't like any of them. I'm hiding my team, okay? There's a hotel in Athens where no one can find us. 2 players per room.
The AD frowned and said,
But our team headquarters is the Marriott. That's where all of us, including the fans, will be staying.
Have fun there. All the more reason to hide the kids. I don't want them getting pestered. Murray told me last night that he's been approached by 3 runners working for agents. They know he rooms with Sully, and he's reminded them that contact is illegal at this point. But these guys know how to work the system. You see where this is going? The talking heads have projected the kid going high in the draft. The vultures are circling, which will be fine when the season is over. Right now, I don't want him distracted.
All 3 had watched SportsCenter and knew the buzz. The president asked,
You see him in the draft?
No, he's too young, too raw, too immature.
But he scored 58 against Duke.
In college basketball, everyone has an agenda.
Lonnie was looking for a bigger job, and Sully might help. Sully would soon be tempted to declare for the draft and explore its options. An agent would whisper wonderful things to him and dangle the cash. Once money was involved, loyalties would begin to shift. The AD said,
Okay, you want us to reserve the rooms?
No, it's already done.
Will you tell us where the team is staying?
Only if you promise not to ask Sully for a selfie.
The AD laughed and said,
We have a bunch of requests for seats on the plane.
Save them. We're taking the bus.
The bus? It's a 6-hour drive to Atlanta.
Yep, and Sully prefers the bus. I'm sure he'll study all the way down there.
Come on, coach, the president said. We can't arrive for the Sweet 16 in a bus.
What do we know about Sweet 16 arrivals?
Good point,
the AD said.
If Sully wants a bus, then take the bus.
Miss Ida had them up and eating breakfast by 8. Ernie lingered for a final word. They were concerned that their 2 players had shown no interest in their academic pursuits for at least the past week and would probably want to skip Monday's classes. After Ernie left, Miss Ida made Sully promise to go to class. Actually, he wanted to. There were 2 extremely cute girls in American history. When he walked in 5 minutes late, the entire class stood and cheered. The professor was a good sport and enjoyed the celebration. Sully sat behind the girls in his usual spot and opened his laptop. After 15 minutes, the professor realized that her lecture was not being heard by anyone, especially Sully, who was online with the girls. The professor walked from behind the lectern and said,
Can I have your attention, please? Thank you. How many of you have younger brothers and sisters at home?
Almost all of the students raised their hands.
And how many of you have been asked by your younger siblings to get a photo with Mr. Suleiman?
All hands went up. She smiled and continued.
Thought so. I have a 12-year-old son, and if I go home without a photo, he won't speak to me. Sully, please forgive me for disrupting your classwork, but if you will indulge us, I will excuse all absences from last week and this week. Deal?
The class cheered again, and Sully ambled down to the front. The school wanted some sort of glorious send-off, an old-fashioned pep rally, with speeches, cheerleaders, a band, and students packed in the stands. But Lonnie nixed it. More adulation wouldn't do a damn thing to help win the game against Providence. He ran them hard Tuesday afternoon, then told them to shower, change, hustle up, and get on the bus. As they left campus, Roy Tice yelled back,
Say, Sully, next week when we go to the Final Four, can we take a plane? My app says it's 32 hours to Phoenix by car, straight shot on Interstate 40.
Sully had his earbuds in and pretended not to hear. His eyes were closed as if in deep meditation. Others began griping about the bus ride, but they were too excited to really care. Coach Britt got their attention when he ran an edited game film of Providence thrashing a good Butler team in the second round, and he reminded them that, once again, they were on the low end of a 6-point spread. Still, no respect.